Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments. From Joseph to Benedict. Following in the footsteps of a saint and another pope. Peace Day message of his pontificate focusing on truth and peace, Pope Benedict XVI said that countries have a duty to respect international humanitarian law even during conflicts and wars. After expressing hope for a more serene world in the future, at the beginning of his message he also pays tribute to his predecessors, the great popes Paul VI and John Paul II, describing them as astute promoters of peace and tireless heralds of the gospel, but also to two other figures dear to him, a pope and a saint. Let's listen to the text of this message read for us by Chris Altieri.
I wish to reiterate the steadfast resolve of the Holy See to continue serving the cause of peace. The very name Benedict, which I chose on the day of my election to the chair of Peter, is a sign of my personal commitment to peace. In taking this name, I wanted to evoke both the patron saint of Europe who inspired the civilization of peace on the whole continent, and Pope Benedict XV, who condemned the First World War as a useless slaughter and worked for a universal acknowledgement of the lofty demands of peace.
So at this point in the broadcast, I thought I'd evoke the figures of the two Benedicts who've so inspired our current Holy Father. Beginning with Saint Benedict, the patron saint of Europe, as described to us by the abbot primate of the Benedictine Confederation, Notker Wolf. In a few moments, he'll be telling us what it means to follow in the footsteps of Saint Benedict, respecting a rule dating back a millennium and a half.
According to my opinion, the rule of Saint Benedict is very relevant to modern society. And I'm giving always, or from time to time at least, conferences for managers. And because it's a way of living together, where you are respecting each other, the individual is respected, and you know that nobody is perfect, you accept also this, and you integrate it, and that the individual has to be integrated into a community, and that you have a responsibility in front of God, that God is, in the end, the center of our life, where we are coming from, where we are going to, and He's also present in this world. In this way, I think it's very important to see this. Now, if I'm flattered or not, I was astonished when I heard this name, and of course I was happy. It's not that we would be chauvinists, that we would say, now we have special relations to the Pope, and he is especially for the Benedictines. But he knows the Benedictines quite well from Bavaria. In Bavaria we have 17 Benedictine monasteries, and most of the monasteries are running schools, and they are very famous. So the whole of the Bavarian mentality throughout the centuries have been marked by very much by the Benedictine mentality. And Pope Benedict XVI, he himself, when he was a young man, was thinking of joining a Benedictine monastery. And now, during the past years, every year he made his private retreat in a Benedictine monastery in Bavaria.
If you had to pinpoint another two reasons why he picked this name, what would they be?
I would say, on one hand, he loves the rule of Saint Benedict. There is a most balanced rule. Then he is surely continuing the line of Pope John Paul II, the fight for a Europe of values. And it was on the 24th of October in 64 that Paul VI had proclaimed at Monte Cassino Benedict as patron saint of Europe.
L'ideale dell'unità spirituale dell'Europa, e non manchi loro l'aiuto dall'alto per realizzarlo in pratici e provvidi ordinamenti che abbiamo voluto proclamare San Benedetto patrono e patrone dell'Europa.
Because it was especially, and maybe that this is also somehow the thought of our new Pope, that the Benedictines were the stable centers at the fringe from the Roman Empire to the Middle Ages. That's to say, when the Roman Empire collapsed and there were so many migrations of peoples, it was a horrible, chaotic time. In such a time, it was the monks really who created a kind of new culture or conserved. It was based upon the Greek and Roman culture on one hand. They were copying the books and so on. And on the other hand, they mixed it and made a good unity with the Christian message. And I think that the Pope is hoping that something similar will happen for the future in Europe. Of course, the monasteries themselves, they are no longer that strong as they had been in during these times. But in the whole, that the church is kind of a leaven in Europe to preserve the values, the Christian values, which, according to his and of course also of my opinion, are the real human values. You can't be a human being without God. And so I think this is at least one of the mainstream, perhaps, of why he has chosen this name. Of course, maybe also of because he thought of Benedict the 15th, who was also a man of trying to make peace in this world. Who was already in favor of United Nations, but he wanted more a fraternal or familiar living together. He was not so much a politician in that sense. So I think it could be these two things or these two thoughts or reasons might be why he has chosen this name, and maybe also another one. We as Benedictines, we have been founded far much earlier than all the divisions within the European Christian churches.
And St. Benedict is also celebrated by the Orthodox Church, no?
Benedict is a figure of linking, of unifying, and there are, for example, also Anglican Benedictine monasteries. There are Lutheran Benedictine monasteries, because we are all, our rule is much earlier than all kind of separation and division, and brings people together.
The rule of hospitality.
Yes, even we are good friends with Buddhist monks, and they are coming to us. We are sharing our life with them, and sometimes we are going also to see them. So there is a rather openness on one hand, and on the other hand, it's a basic, solid, unideological Christianity we are living out. Yeah, and the whole way of life, it's living out the gospel, I would say. It's the concrete living of the gospel every day, how to live together. If you go through the rule, it's like, I would say, like digesting the Holy Scripture. Saint Benedict was so absorbed, or he had so absorbed the Holy Scripture. So it's not an application, but it's just living out. That's the mystery. And nowadays, for example, when we are doing our so-called Lectio Divina, which means our reading of the gospel in front of God, in front of asking for his spirit, so it soaks into your bones. And this will just mark your whole life. It's not that you take one phrase and you say, now you have, because of that, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to live like this, but it becomes a natural way of life.
It's a very broad approach to life, because you have a very simple ora et labora approach, and yet you are the keepers of culture in Western Europe.
Ora et labora is too little. This phrase was once mentioned in the Middle Ages, but it comes from the 19th century now. But it's missing the studies and reading. So I would say ora, study, and labora. So there are three things which belong together. And culture was always a normal thing of a Benedictine monasteries. We are running big schools. We are all around the world. We have about 150,000 students we are teaching. So therefore, I have also formed an international commission for Benedictine education.
Isn't it a bit too elitish?
No, by no means.
The whole monastic approach to life was addressed to an elite.
By no means. Benedict didn't have many priests in his community. He himself was no priest. And it came through the Middle Ages when the whole church has become so clericalized that in the end there were only priests in the monasteries. But if I'm looking to my monastery where I'm coming from, St. Ottilian, among 100 monks living on this place, two-thirds are non-academic people who have never studied, but they are working several handcrafts, the basic handcrafts like, let me start with butchery, bakery, or carpentry, electricity, the plumbing, all this kind. We have a large farm. This was always the tradition, has been the tradition of Benedictine life. Of course, there have been monasteries who have only studied people. This is something different. But our life has never been in this way an elite, but it was a rather simple life.
Well, thanks there go to Abbot Primate of the Benedictine Confederation, Notker Wolf, for sharing with us his thoughts on St. Benedict. And now on a very different note, you can join me as I take a step back in time in an effort to catch a glimpse of that last pope to take the name Benedict. Gone down in history as Papa della Chiesa, he was elected to the See of Peter on the 3rd of September 1914 and died on the 2nd of January 1922. Stay tuned to echoes of that wartime pontificate, as related to me by some of the very people who belonged to that era, beginning with Rosminian Father Charles Leroux, who recalls being taken to pay homage to Benedict XV, lying in state back in 1922. He was only 8 years old, and the episode made a lasting impression on him. You saw Benedict XV as a corpse. He was known as tiny, no?
Very tiny. As a corpse, tiny because the bed they put up, that kind of pedestal, it's more a pedestal, is of course the same for every pope. So the memory I have is that there was an enormous margin between the feet and the end of the pedestal.
So he was tiny?
He was tiny, yes.
The famous anecdote when he is elected Pope and he goes off into the Sala Lacrimatoria, the crying room as they used to call it, the sacristy outside of the Sistine Chapel, to try on one of the three sizes of papal garment. And of course he was so small that he didn't fit into any of them.
Pope Benedict XV's biographer, John Pollard, said that while undoubtedly lacking in looks, the Pope was anything but lacking in a sense of humour.
And the poor old Vatican tailor had to frantically rush around with pins and whatever to put him into the smallest. And he is alleged to have turned to the tailor and said, "Well, my dear, you didn't think much of my chances, did you?"
Unlike his predecessor, Pope Pius X, who was a man of the people, Pope Benedict XV came from rather a grand background.
He was related to the author of the Gattopardo, of the Princess of Lampedusa. Yes. Very ugly. but a very good family. Yeah, della Chiesa, a very good family. The noble guards represented a higher class guard, guardian of the name of the Pope and the Pope. And our class had the privilege of having a stand of its own.
As the son of a colonel of the noble guard, Marquis Mario Teodoli had the privilege of attending many of the official ceremonies presided over by Pope Benedict XV.
15 or 16, I had a black tie and tails. There's a difference, because you never wear tails with a black tie, but only with a white tie, yes. But in black tie, that was because of reverence to the Vatican and to the Pope. That was what the routine was. Because all the families went, and we were all dressed up and everything, and of course it was sort of boring for children. All the mass, the ceremonies were done in Latin, of course. We used to sing too in Latin, the Credo and the Ave Maria and all that, yes. And we had the privilege of being received by the Holy Father every year for in January sometime to present our wishes for a new year. And there was...
like Marquis Mario Teodoli, Count Carlo Cardelli also belonged to the so-called black aristocracy, the Roman families that had sided with the Pope when he was deprived of his temporal power, and who had served him faithfully ever since. He too remembered dressing up to be received by the Pope.
Swallowed his frack, and the ladies were in black dress and no jewels except pearls, white jewels, and a veil and long dresses, of course. And the children were also admitted. All the families were grouped and blessed them and asked them, inquired on their families and their problems. It was small not very graceful in his figure, but very dignified, a grand seigneur, and a diplomat.
Not very graceful, but a diplomat. Pope Benedict XV may not have fitted into the robes of his predecessor, but as a diplomat he certainly fitted into his role as a pope at a crucial moment in European history. In fact, while the Count and the Marquis were attending solemn-sounding ceremonies in the Vatican, elsewhere throughout Europe, young men were leaving for the front, their farewells accompanied by often rather light-hearted music. Once away from home, these same young men were faced with the stark reality of warfare. Stuck in muddy trenches, they faced sickness, shell shock, and death. In London, in August 1914, shortly before Pius X's death, English Foreign Secretary Earl Grey said,
"The lamps are going out all over Europe. We shall not see them lit again in our lifetime."
When Pope Pius X died later that month, Germany, France, Austria, Russia, Serbia, Belgium, and Britain were at war. People said he died of a broken heart. The mere idea of a great war had proved too much for him to bear. In Moscow, the last French ambassador to the Russian court, Maurice Paleologue, thought of the papacy as having an unprecedented role in that bleak-looking Europe.
Pope Pius X died last night. Will any conclave ever open in graver circumstances or in the midst of greater upheaval of human affairs? Will the College of Cardinals find in its ranks a pontiff with sufficient humanity, depth of piety, strength of character, and astuteness of intellect to play the capital and unprecedented role which the war offers to the Holy See?
And when the cardinals did gather in conclave and elected Pope Benedict XV, the man they chose to play that capital and unprecedented role which the war offered to the Holy See proved to be no fortuitous choice. He was an experienced diplomat. But even a refined diplomat like Pope Benedict XV could run into trouble. Father Charles Roux remembered the remarks made by several literary personalities of the era soon after the war.
I had come to Rome from London, in fact, because my father was a diplomat and was in London when the war broke out and was called up and then wounded at Gallipoli and then posted here. And my mother joined him here from Rome with my nanny. I do remember that persons like Ilhè Belloc, who was the correspondent of the Times here during the war, and Paul Claudel, who was the Consul General of France, and I don't know, they had taken a liking to me, though I was a small child of 6 or 7, and they had taken me out once to tea, to the scandal of Nanny, who made a scene to my mother when we got back, because instead of taking me to Babington, to a decent tea house, they had taken me to a trattoria, and those two men had dared to order wine and eat cheese and sing aloud in a public place. And I was supposed never to accept an invitation from those two rogues again. But I remember that those two, for instance, didn't like Benedict XV at all, because, you know, they were nationalists. They accused Benedict XV of not being on the side of the Allies. And Benedict XV, like Pius X, had refused to take part. Pius X had refused a blessing to the Austrian armies and say, I bless peace, I don't bless armies. And Benedict XV had done all he could to try and stop a war where Christians were killing Christians. And that wasn't accepted in the mentality of the times, and wanted Benedict XV to be a Tommy or a poilu.
I hope you enjoyed that. Now, on a more reflective note, we move on and join Monsignor Peter Fleetwood.
Sometimes you hear theories suggesting that Shakespeare was really Chinese, or arguments about whether St. Patrick was Welsh or Scottish or even English. Usually the people who put these ideas about are clever but mad. Well, I would like to join them and suggest that St. Benedict was from my home city of Liverpool. Why? Because the first words in his famous rule for monks are obsculta fili, if I'm not mistaken, and they are words you often hear said at home. Listen, son. But the proof that my theory is totally mad is in the fact that Benedict put these words at the beginning of a reasoned and reasonable way of encouraging monks to live harmoniously in community. But when people in Liverpool say, "Listen, son," the tone is usually quite menacing. They may even be drunk. But in any case, the one who says those words is about to put you in your place. Benedict's rule starts wisely. Unless we listen, we can never hear. If we do not hear, we shall not learn. Another word used in religious life is obedience, which comes from another Latin word for hearing or listening. So Benedict sets the tone for his rule with the idea that the monks should pay close attention and take seriously what the people who had authority over them said. This has become difficult and unfashionable in our day for at least two reasons. First of all, it is hard to listen. Listening properly means giving someone our full attention, and to do that, we need to be able to hear them. But if your town is anything like where I live, It is so noisy these days that it is hard to block out background noise, even when you're asleep. Young people seem to enjoy incredibly loud music in discotheques, and I've sometimes heard disc jockeys on radio programmes saying that if it's too loud, you're too old. The volume of music sometimes seems dangerously high, but that seems to be what they want, or what someone has convinced them they want. Other people are just so busy that they find it hard to listen in the sense of concentrating properly. So listening is not at all easy these days. Why bother listening? It's no fun. Secondly, there is what one friend of mine describes as a culture of contempt in the background of many people's minds. Some people rationalise it by giving it the fancy name of postmodernism, but very often it is something that simply insinuates its way into our minds without us noticing, so that it is easier to believe the newspapers when they say that Pope Pius XII was evil because he failed to help the Jews. It is simpler to ignore the many facts that would contradict the nonsense the press so often peddle on this subject. Quite a few people seem to be gloating over the current crisis of confidence in the Church because of mishandling of delicate situations in the past. They really seem to enjoy seeing bishops and priests humiliated. I'm not saying justice should be sidetracked, by the way, but what cannot escape our notice is the way institutions are no longer trusted or respected. And that's true of so many institutions, not just the Church. Nowadays, people in my own country are unlikely to listen to politicians or the police without making quite critical comments. So it's easy to understand why people wonder why they should bother listening to people or organisations they no longer trust. All I'm saying is that I understand why many people find it hard to listen properly. But it is a shame when that means people listen to nobody. How can they learn anything worth learning? By all means, be careful and choose carefully the people to whom you listen, but there must be someone to trust. If you think about Mass on a Sunday, ask yourself how much you take in when you listen to the readings from the Word of God. In the midst of busy lives, it's not easy to avoid distraction, is it? But ask yourself who told you the last good joke you heard, or gave you a great piece of advice, said an encouraging word, or made you believe someone loves you. Then you realise it is worth bothering. There are some people to whom we really should listen. Without them, life would be awful, wouldn't it? So stay tuned.
Our thanks there, as always, to Monsignor Peter Fleetwood for sharing with us this reflection. And that's all I have time for on today's broadcast, which I hope you really enjoyed. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.